Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're tackling something a lot of people are asking about: fertility coverage. Specifically, how employers can offer things like IVF without getting tangled up in all the usual healthcare rules.
Yeah, it's a hot topic. Employers definitely want to offer these benefits. It's huge for recruitment, for retention. But, you know, adding comprehensive fertility coverage to your main health plan, that triggers a whole host of ACA compliance issues. It can be a massive headache.
Right. So this new guidance seems to offer some shortcuts.
Exactly. Regulatory shortcuts. We're looking at FAQs released October 16th, 2025 from the tri-agencies, that's Treasury, Labor, HHS. It's officially Affordable Care Act Implementation Part 72. Sounds dry, but the impact is pretty immediate.
Okay, so our mission today is to break down how employers can, essentially right now, use these guidelines to offer fertility benefits by classifying them as IPA-accepted benefits.
That's the core idea. And just to quickly define accepted benefits for everyone listening, these are benefits that, crucially, get a pass on many of the big IPA and ACA market reform rules.
Like, what kind of rules are we talking about bypassing?
Well, things like the non-discrimination rules based on health status, the ban on annual or lifetime dollar limits, even some preventive care mandates. If it qualifies as accepted, it operates under a different, much lighter set of rules.
And this specific guidance, this clarification, it didn't just appear out of thin air, did it? Was there a push for this?
Oh, absolutely not random. This was a direct response, and a pretty quick one, to an executive order from February 2025, EO 14216.
Ah, the one on expanding access to in vitro fertilization.
That's the one. It basically told the agencies, find ways to protect IVF access and lower costs and do it fast. So the agencies looked around and realized clarifying these existing accepted benefit rules was, you know, the quickest lever they could pull. It's policy triage, really.
Makes sense. A faster path than full rulemaking.
Yeah.
So they found basically three existing doors marked accepted benefits that fertility coverage could potentially fit through. Let's tackle the first one, which sounds maybe the most comprehensive. Independent, non-coordinated benefits.
Right. This category already exists for things like, say, cancer insurance policies or hospital indemnity insurance. Specific, standalone coverage. The FAQs confirm you can structure fertility benefits this way.
Okay, pause there. Is the guidance basically saying infertility itself can be treated as a specified disease or illness just for the purpose of fitting into this accepted benefit box?
That's essentially the implication, yes. If you structure the benefit narrowly, maybe as an infertility treatment policy, you can use this pathway. But, and this is key, there are three very strict conditions you absolutely have to meet.
Okay, what are they? Lay them out for us.
Condition one, it has to be under a completely separate policy. A separate insurance contract, certificate, whatever, not just a rider on your main medical plan.
Total separate paper. Got it. Let's two.
Second, there can be no coordination between this benefit and any exclusions in the main group health plan.
Wait, unpack that. So if my main plan specifically says we don't cover IVF, this separate fertility policy has to pretend it doesn't know that. It can't interact with that exclusion.
Precisely. It has to operate completely independently. Condition three builds on that. Benefits must be paid out regardless of whether the main plan covers anything for the same event. It proves it's truly supplemental, truly separate.
Okay, clear conditions. Now, you mentioned some critical limitations earlier. One was about funding.
Yes, absolutely critical. Under the current rules laid out here, this must be an insured policy. The employer cannot self-insure this specific type of accepted benefit. They have to buy it from a carrier.
Insured only. Okay. And the other point, about who can enroll.
Also important, employees don't need to be enrolled in the employer's main group health plan to get this separate fertility coverage. They could have coverage elsewhere or none at all and still potentially access this benefit if the employer offers it, makes it more accessible.
Right. Okay. Now, this is where I think it gets really interesting for employees, especially those trying to manage high costs, the HSA connection. Why is this particular structure potentially a game changer for people with health savings accounts?
This is the aha moment, I think. Because this type of coverage qualifies as specified disease or illness insurance, the tax code specifically, code section 223, allows someone enrolled in it to still be eligible to contribute to their HSA.
So wait, I can have the separate fertility insurance and keep making my pre-tax HSA contributions?
Yes, that's what the guidance concerns. Normally, having other broad health coverage disqualifies you from HSA contributions, but there's this specific carve-out for specified disease insurance. So you can have this policy and use your tax-free HSA dollars to pay for deductibles, co-pays, or other uncovered fertility costs.
Wow. Okay, that is huge. Because we're talking IVF cycles costing, what, $15,000, $20,000, even more sometimes. Being able to use pre-tax HSA funds is a massive financial benefit.
It really is. It makes the coverage significantly more affordable in practice. But remember that insured-only limitation we just talked about.
Right, so employers can't self-fund this yet. Did the agency say anything about that changing?
They did, actually. They explicitly stated in the FAQs that they intend to pursue future rulemaking, the formal notice and comment process, specifically to look at allowing these kinds of limited accepted benefits to be self-funded by employers.
Okay, so that's a watch this space situation. But for now, path one requires an insurance carrier.
Correct. For immediate action, it's insured only.
All right. Let's shift gears. What if an employer doesn't want to buy a whole separate insurance policy, but still wants to offer some direct financial help for fertility costs? Path two, accepted benefit HRAs.
Exactly. Health reimbursement arrangements, or HRAs, configured as accepted benefits. These are already quite common for things like dental or vision expenses. It's basically a pot of money the employer provides.
Okay, but these have their own set of rules, don't they? It's not just free money.
No, definitely not. There are four main conditions for an HRA to qualify as accepted. First, the employer has to offer a regular group health plan, too. This HRA can't be the only health benefit offered.
Makes sense. Condition two.
There's an annual dollar limit on the amount the employer can put into the HRA for an employee. For 2025 plan years, that limit is set at $2,150. It gets indexed for inflation each year.
$2,150. Okay,
Yeah.
that's a hard cap. What else?
Third, the HRA generally can't be used to reimburse premiums for other health insurance. And fourth, it has to be offered on the same terms to all similarly situated employees. You can't discriminate based on health status.
Okay, that $2,150 limit, let's be realistic. Given IVF costs, this HRA isn't going to cover a full treatment cycle, is it? What's its practical use for fertility?
You're right, it won't cover a whole cycle, but it's extremely useful for covering, say, initial diagnostic tests, consultations, maybe some medications, co-pays for visits related to fertility, those out-of-pocket costs that add up quickly. The FAQs confirm employers can use this $2,150 HRA specifically for those fertility-related expenses.
Does the employer have to limit it to fertility, or could it just be a general HRA that employees happen to use for fertility costs?
That's a great point about flexibility. The employer actually has a choice in the design. They could set up the HRA to reimburse any qualified out-of-pocket medical expense under Section 213 of the tax code up to that $2,150 limit.
Right.
Or they could design the HRA specifically to only reimburse fertility-related out-of-pocket expenses so they can target the funds if that's their goal.
Interesting. So targeted support or general support, but capped at that $2,150. A much simpler structure than the separate insurance policy, but obviously less comprehensive coverage.
Exactly. It's a defined contribution approach. Predictable cost for the employer, some help for the employee, but limited scope.
Okay, that brings us to the third and maybe the most restrictive sounding path, using an employee assistance program or EAP. How does that work for fertility? I thought EAPs had strict rules about medical care.
They absolutely do, and that's the main hurdle here. For an EAP to maintain its accepted benefit status, which is crucial, it cannot provide significant benefits in the nature of medical care. That's the regulatory language.
Significant benefits in the nature of medical care. Okay, that sounds like a major barrier for something like fertility treatment. So, what can EAP do under this guidance?
The FAQs drew a very specific, very narrow line. They clarified that an EAP won't be considered to provide significant medical care just because it offers things like coaching or navigator
Not the
services.
coaching and navigation, like what exactly?
Think informational support, helping employees understand their treatment options, finding specialists in their area, maybe help navigating insurance paperwork or understanding clinic success rates, guidance, resources, support, but not actual medical procedures or treatments.
So the EAP can talk about fertility treatment, but it can't pay for any part of it. No consult fees, no blood tests, no medications.
Precisely. The moment it starts covering actual medical services, it likely crosses that significant medical care line and risks losing its accepted benefit status entirely, which would pull the whole EAP under ACA rules.
Yikes. Okay. Are there other restrictions on EAPs used this way?
Yes. Besides avoiding significant medical care, it also can't coordinate benefits with the main health plan. Employees can't be required to pay a premium or contribution for it, and there can be absolutely no cost sharing, like co-pays, for the EAP services. It has to be free, separate, and non-medical in its core benefits.
Given all that, it sounds like using an EAP for comprehensive fertility support is basically impossible. So what's the practical strategy here for employers?
The smart play seems to be a split approach. Use the EAP only for what it's good at under these rules. The coaching, the navigation, the emotional support, the resource finding. That's valuable stuff and relatively low cost.
Okay, use the EAP for the guidance part.
Right. And then the actual medical services, the diagnostics, the treatments, the drugs, those need to be covered elsewhere, either through the main major medical plan if it offers coverage, or through one of the other two accepted benefit paths we just discussed, that separate insured specified disease policy, or the accepted benefit HRA.
So you kind of layer the strategies, EAP for support, and then either the insured policy or the HRA for the actual medical costs if the main plan doesn't cover it.
That seems to be the most logical way to structure it based on this guidance, yeah.
Okay, let's zoom out. We've covered these three paths clarified by the October 2025 FAQs. Mm-hmm. What's the big takeaway for you, for the listener, whether they're an employer trying to figure this out or an employee hoping for better coverage?
I think the biggest takeaway is that there are immediate options available now. The regulatory pathway is clearer. Employers don't have to wait for massive plan overhauls or future legislation to start offering meaningful fertility support outside the main medical plan.
So path one, the independent insured policy. More comprehensive, potentially allows HSA contributions, but needs a carrier partner.
Right. Path two, the accepted benefit HRA, simpler, defined contribution, $2,150 cap for 2025, good for out-of-pocket costs, can be targeted specifically to fertility.
And path three, the EAP. Very restricted, only for coaching and navigation, not actual medical care, but useful for support when combined with other coverage.
That sums it up nicely. These are tools employers can deploy quickly, leveraging existing accepted benefit frameworks, largely thanks to that push from the executive order demanding faster solutions.
It really feels like a practical, if maybe interim, solution. Use existing rules to get something moving, while the slower process of potential new rulemaking, like for self-funded options, takes place.
Exactly. It's a bridge. It provides immediate clarity and options while signaling where things might go next, particularly with that mention of future rulemaking for self-funded accepted benefits.
Which brings us to a final thought to leave you with. Right now, that first path, the independent coverage, must be insured. Employers have to pay premiums to an insurance company. But the agencies explicitly said they plan to look into allowing self-funded versions in the future.
So the question to ponder is, if employers could self-fund these specific accepted fertility benefits, cutting out the insurance carrier, what would that unlock? Would it mean significant cost savings, more administrative flexibility? Could it lead to even wider adoption as employers gain more control over the benefit design and cost? How might that change the whole landscape of fertility benefits becoming a standard offering?
Something definitely worth thinking about as this area continues to evolve.